Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.
So hi Mitty, thank you for being here. Your name is Mitty Arbon.
Mityana Arbon, yes.
Mityana Arbon.
But Mitty for short is better. I'm the curator here at the Museum of Anthropology. I'm the curator for the Pacific Collection, which is the warmer waters where I'm connected to, so the islands of Samoa. But I'm also responsible for parts of the region like Fiji, Australia, Solomon Islands, Papua New Guinea. And thinking about how I kind of host communities here and also connect them a little bit to the Indigenous nations in this part of Canada. Right now we're sort of standing outside the Museum of Anthropology. It's a little bit cold today as the weather changes to the wet of winter in Vancouver. And what better way to start with the wet than with this wonderful mural here by Susan Points called Salish Footprints. When the Museum of Anthropology was built, or MOA as we like to call it, in the 70s, the government with these huge signs outside wanted to kind of talk about their work in highlighting culture and the arts. But at the time in the 70s, when the Canadian government was rethinking how they evaluated Indigenous art, they weren't thinking about the specificity of place. So more recently, the museums had to try and think about whose land are we on? How are we connected not just to other communities which we hold in the collection, but also to the lands of the Musqueam people that we're situated on today? So Salish Footprints is about that, to think about the footprints of the land, the Salish community here of Musqueam, or the Musqueam people. And to remind everyone that walks into the museum across this mural of salmon that are swimming about the waters and the lands that we're on here today. There is also a much larger carving up there by Susan Point. Susan is very famous for being a female carver. Women aren't often carvers traditionally in up and down the coast here in British Columbia. So she's really pushing the boundaries and both reclaiming historical carving practices, but also asserting this more gender equal way of thinking.
What age is she?
I'm actually not sure what age. This was done in 2010. I want to say she's must be in her 40s now.
Mm. And she lives in Vancouver?
Yeah, she lives down on the reserve in Musqueam. Mm.
Comes she over sometimes to have a look?
We'll be working on a project with her to restore some pieces by her, and I can highlight one of the main pieces as well in the Great Hall. And I think this is also a really important stop. The first thing that you see when you walk into the museum again.
So nice to be here again.
Oh, yes, yeah. I'm glad. The first thing that you see here today, Nadia, is a series of belongings that mix together the different values that we're thinking about in our curatorial work. We want to, again, kind of reassert that Musqueam are the people here. So the first thing that you should see here is Musqueam treasures and Musqueam stories. And this beautiful carved houseboard. Do you know what a houseboard is?
No.
Houseboards are these beautifully carved, almost like, they sometimes people use the word storyboards, and they sit inside a traditional longhouse. So then when you walk in the main entrance and you're sitting in this longhouse, you'll see these stories around that talk about Musqueam and if it's a different nation around here, they're kind of stories to do with land and politics. This one talks about an ancestor. It's called the Similano Houseboard, an ancestor of one of the families of Musqueam, a chief, and in his right hand he holds a rattle, and the left hand he holds a knife. And using only words that he knows, he could speak to the bear and the bear would come out of his cave and allow him to kill it. And so it talks a little bit about the family and the relationship between this Musqueam ancestor with an animal in the land and their kind of special kind of place here where we are today. But this was gifted to UBC in the 20s. And it's where we hold it on behalf of Musqueam. And we're very conscious about having it here and the kind of power that this story speaks to, but also to kind of bring it into the constellation of discussions about other art forms that are being revitalized, like Salish blanket weaving. I'm not sure if you know much about the importance of blankets.
I would like you to tell us.
Well, I can only tell my kind of stories that I know in a little way, but blankets play a very important part in ceremonies here, particularly in this part of Canada, where blanketing is a very symbolic act in it's a culmination of certain ceremonies to do with potlatching and naming. Often, as a witness, I was a witness to a recent potlatch at Musqueam. One of the final acts was them to stand on a blanket and to be blanketed. And it has a lot of symbolism that I'm still kind of unraveling.
Mm-hmm.
But today,
maybe you can explain what potlatch means to you.
Oh yeah, I will actually explain as we walk further down.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But this one is a mix, as you can see, between very old stories, some modern revitalization, and also contemporary art. This is a huge, huge spindle. Very often when I think we think of spindles, we think of a very small spinning wheel, but this one looks like the size of a car tire with a huge long metal piece through it. This is actually the size of an old spindle, to just kind of give you a sense of it, but to show that we try and mix around the stories. We're not just about this, I know, idea of anthropology that I don't fully subscribe to. Mm-hmm. I come from a more inclusive, critical Indigenous way of thinking from my own community.
Mm-hmm.
But we try and blend the stories with art, with new revitalizations in the older parts of the past. I'm going to probably highlight this wonderful artwork I like.
Mm.
Have you seen this before?
No.
Loire sous les Indiens, the Indian art. This is actually an ephemera from a performance artwork. Do you want to describe it for people?
Yes.
So it's this kind of floating legal document, the Indian art. Dated 1985. The Indian Act is a very long and ongoing piece of legislation. It was sort of created around the 1880s, and it's a legislation that has been reformed many times but has led to the kind of situation of a lot of Indigenous communities across Canada. It's a legislation that bans ceremonies like potlatch that we'll touch on later. It's the act that also created a residential school system and everything that we kind of think negatively in terms of the situation of Indigenous communities here in Canada. And so the artist, Lawrence Paul Yulwe Lupton, he's very famous. He's also a painter, well known for his paintings. He wanted to think about the pain and the power of Indian Act, not just as a piece of legislation, but a physical act. And so this piece is called An Indian Act Shooting the Indian Act. And as part of this particular one, he's done it several times. He was at a shooting range in the UK, and he lined up the legislation, and using a shotgun, which was a service rifle, a very famous service rifle, Lee Enfield service rifle, the main kind of British Commonwealth kind of service rifle. He used the act as a target practice and shot all these pieces of legislation and sent them out to various British politicians and also to Canadian politicians. And he kind of wanted to, both the act of shooting it and the act, the violent act of the legislation, he kind of wanted to bring them into conversation and show that power and frustration that communities have about the kind of current situation. And I always like to use this act and start with this artwork because it really connects then to a lot of what we see around potlatching and what we hold here today. Communities are still live and have to kind of reconcile their lives within this framework. Oh, these have just come back. Mm-hmm. I'm very excited to show you this. I haven't actually seen these two before. Normally here there was, for the last year, an empty series of mounts. These mounts were empty because these beautiful feast spoons were sent back for a potlatching community. But they've just returned. Do you know much about potlatch, Nadia?
I think I'm completely ignorant.
Oh, well, I must say I'm also ignorant to a certain extent. As a newcomer here to Coast Salish territory, I'm still learning about the levels of meaning and depth that these ceremonies can have. But my kind of small take on it and what I've been taught by my colleagues mm-hmm. is to think of potlatch as almost like a series of ceremonies. In the past, they were a way of transmitting stories of legal rights, of acknowledging important occasions in the community. And with that came a series of actions, ritualized actions, feasts, distributions, dancing. And depending on which nation you are, they have a very different shape and form. But this kind of power of the potlatch was what led them to be banned under the Indian Act. So between 1885 and 1951, potlatching, all these ceremonies were outlawed under the threat of either incarceration in prison, you could be fined, and also what you produced for these feasts would be confiscated by the government and were often sold to other museums around the world or distributed to other museums in Canada. And so I'm very sure that a lot of what you see in museums in the US and even in Europe from this kind of particular period of time often came from confiscations. And it was a way to kind of control people. These ceremonies were forms of legal. They had like legal rights to it. I was told when I witnessed a potlatch for a naming ceremony that the audience, the witnesses, are just as important as the people who are holding the ceremony. The witnesses are, in a legal sense, witnessing, not signing a piece of paper, but witnessing the gifting of these rights and names. And our right is to share as witnesses the story of what happens to ensure that people know and have proof. So during this period of time, they were outlawed, 1885 to 1951, but they're kind of starting again and starting again in these new ways. And at the museum, it's this thing I've been learning about, that we often hold a lot of these belongings, and on these platforms, you'll see lots of huge feast bowls. This one in the shape of a fox, mm-hmm. a seal, and a spoon here. Depending on which nation they're from, seal is a Kwakwaka'wakw. Mm-hmm. If the family from Smith's Inlet would like to use it for a wedding feast or wedding potlatch, then they can request this from the museum and we'll take it out to them and they can use it in their ceremonies. Like this, these two spoons were used for a wedding feast, actually.
Nice.
And it's part of the really fun thing about Moa is that we really kind of hold and work with community in special ways. And it's not very often that you'll send such things out to a community to be activated and used and then mm-hmm. brought back again.
So you're the archive and you're keeping these things and then they just bring them back and...
Yeah, it's a very dynamic relationship. Yeah. And I can also show you what happens when we return things permanently. So right now we're sort of walking down into the Great Hall. It has a wonderful echo. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll actually start in the middle of the Great Hall. If you look around the beautiful glass windows, you can see the hall was designed to hold totem poles. This was an original intention of the architect, was to have this space to showcase the large monumental carvings from this part of Canada, often in yellow and red cedar. And he was the architect Arthur Erickson was inspired by a lot of Japanese architecture and playing a lot with light and shadow and compression and openness of space and a sense of, like a ceremony and a flow to the way that the spaces are set out. And so when the Poles were brought here, they were brought in that time where in the 40s, UBC was involved a lot in what was called salvage ethnography, in collecting and bringing things from nations that they thought were dying out or were in under threat of loss, which is a very problematic way of thinking about communities as always dying out. Today, it's new and different, like I described with the feast poles. We work with each nation and each pole that you see here to ensure that their protocols are upheld. But we had to also change the story a little bit. Like I mentioned outside, we're trying to think about speaking directly to the relationship with the community here, the Musqueam community. And these beautiful totem poles that people think about when they think about Indigenous art in Canada aren't actually from Coast Salish territory. These are poles that are from much further north along the coast. So we've intentionally tried to work with Susan Poyne again, and she developed these two house boards to center the story of Musqueam in the middle of the hall. And this is also a story about museums and museum collections that I've recently learned. So these two house boards, there were architectural features. You can see the notch at the top for the beams, and the doorway would have been there in the longhouse. Susan Poyne actually spent a lot of time in New York. New York has the largest collection of Musqueam historical belongings in the world. A lot of them were bought up in the 20s and sent to a museum there. So Susan, in her carvings, wanted to tell the story about going to New York and the fact that she encounters her culture. Similar to me when I have to go to Germany to encounter Samoan cultural belongings, particularly pre-1914. Susan did the same thing, and she would go to New York to research houseboards there. And her story on the houseboards left to right is actually a story about New York and Vancouver. And so at the bottom, you'll see these watery waterways. This is evoking the Hudson River in New York and the Stolo Fraser River here in Vancouver. And the sun beams like the crown on the Statue of Liberty, but also to indicate the sun rising in New York and setting here. It's a kind of conversation between these two spaces. And I mean, as a modern Indigenous person, and Susan is trying to rethink this kind of reality of being Musqueam in the 21st century and bring it into the way that these storyboards encode the history of Musqueam people, even if it is something quite modern and unique as bringing New York into that conversation.
What about these collections in New York? Do you have conversations with the museums there?
I don't, because my specialty is more towards the Pacific. But we have a new curator who's Musqueam, Jordan Wilson. He is doing his PhD through New York and just finishing it up. And he went to New York for the same reason, to do his PhD, because when he looks at historical belongings, that's the kind of real sort of gravity of the past is there. So he's having to go and work in collections over
How
there.
Many kilometers that far up?
Do you know, I've never been to New York before, so I'm...
No, but I was just wondering, it's so far, you know?
It is.
I mean, from here, from Vancouver, it's crazy to
realize. Oh, yeah,
realize. I mean,
6-7 hours to just go there.
And the same thing for you, for coming from Savoie to Bremen to research. And we had this conversation before about you working in Bremen for 3 years. Just looking at all these archives, which are, how were the archives there? I mean, do people know what they have in Bremen in the archives, really?
Well, hopefully people in Samoa do now through my work there. I was in Bremen for 3 years working on a collection, and we can sit over here and chat about it.
Mm-hmm.
Working on going through the German colonial archives of Samoa. And I must say there was also connections here with this part of the coast. Bremen was very much a hub for German colonial shipping. particularly between 1900 to 1914. But for a period of 50 years beforehand, it was very much dominated by Hansestadt's Hanseatic companies, shipping companies like the Norddeutsche Lloyd that still exists today, and other shipping companies from Hamburg that were based in Samoa. And so they would often collect along their routes. Heading towards China was mostly their intended endpoint. And they would collect and set up trading stations, and through the shipping, all these goods and stories and archives would often flow towards Bremen, where the company had set up a museum called the Übersee Museum. And so I was working in a later iteration of this museum. It wasn't called the Übersee Museum at the time. And to try and kind of work with a Samoan community to open up the storage collection and to share as much as possible whilst I was there, often through online workshops because it was during COVID. But I can kind of see the similarities between Susan Point's stories and my colleague Jordan Wilson, in that to really delve deep in, at least into our material past and other forms of... I would say there are other forms of documentation archive, not just the physical paperwork. There are stories and dances and songs that encode in our community these histories. But it is important to delve into these archives to see what's there. And there's often little clues and little pieces of evidences or even just a pattern or a style that is no longer found in the islands. At least for the tropical Pacific, what we made was often deteriorates quite quickly, so in wood and leaves and things. So it's important to see these collections and to kind of connect and understand how certain practices may have changed or altered over time. And for me as a Samoan, to ask the question about what does that mean about us as a community if things look different, or maybe there's a slight emphasis on something else that I've discovered in the archive.
Do people do you have encounters where people are really deeply touched because they see things which they didn't know, or become maybe historians or start studying because of these encounters with these objects which they didn't know before?
Yeah, so there was it wasn't directly related to me, but in one of the workshops we worked with women in Samoa, often known for their weaving. We use weaving for ceremonies and exchange, particularly a very fine form of weaving called an iatonga. When I was in Germany, I discovered all these beautiful mats, and the German term was very strange, like Sottenmatte. Like Zotten, like in
Zotten matter, okay.
But it looks kind of like a sheepskin, all very shaggy, like Zotten.
Okay.
And in Bremen we had dozens of Zotten matter. I've only seen two or three in Auckland before, and it's very hard to find them outside of Germany, these Zotten matter that were often used by high-ranking women as a form of dress. And so in this workshop I pulled out all these different types sometimes in Samoan the word for Zotten matter is iasina. And so I lined up the iasina, and I could feel that there were different qualities in the fiber and different textures and different treatments. To show the full spread, you realize there's really quite a large variety of it. And this is something that I've never seen anywhere else except for in a German collection, because there's never been an opportunity to see such a variety of this one type of object. But for the workshop we ran online, there was a woman who was so excited. She was a weaver, and she had tried to recreate these iasina, these Zotten matter. And she brought hers with her, and we got a beautiful photo. She was just so happy to see that there was much more out there that she hadn't seen before. And even in her very kind of like basic attempt to do it, I'm very excited at the potential that if we could bring some of these pieces back, weavers like her can continue to keep the form alive and to also understand the subtleties of the past that you can sometimes see in these collections.
And just before when you spoke, you said there's this problematic way of approaching indigenous dying communities. So maybe you can tell us a bit more about
I feel like there's a lot of scholars and philosophers that think about this idea, and I think maybe the word tradition is sometimes what they focus on. Is this kind of way of thinking about indigenous cultures that place them always into this tight box, that if they're not doing something that often external people consider to be traditional and as thus authentic, that somehow they've lost their culture. And it gives no shape for the fact that everyone is changing and learning and growing as a being, and cultures bring in new ideas, and they were never isolated. They were always connected in their own ways. And as Samoans, before Europeans arrived, we were connected as well through our own sailing traditions to islands like Wallis and Futuna in the French Pacific and Tonga in the past. And so we were always part of a dynamic cultural expression. And so when Europeans arrived and they saw us, they often had a tendency to freeze everything in which they encountered into this lens that they considered traditional and authentic. And as cultures changed and adapted, then they saw it as losing culture as opposed to responding and changing. Mm. And I remember when I was hosting the Hui Iwi Kua Mo'o, which was a delegation to repatriate Hawaiian human remains when I was in Bremen. They were from Hawaii. And the director at the time, she was like, "Oh, this ceremony is not authentic." She said that to me, and I was shocked. I was like, "Well, it's because we don't have protocols for when German people go to our beach, dig up human graves, put them in a box, and then ship them back to Bremen. Of course, there's not a protocol for that. That is something so wild and so different. It's crazy to think that, you know, it has to somehow appear authentic. It's like, well, there was no authentic protocol for grave robbing from a German." Does that kind of answer your question?
Thank you so much. Yeah.
But I could connect it as well to what we see in the hall.
But we're in this incredible place. I mean, this is such a beautiful museum where we have this height and how big are these sculptures we are?
I would say this is somewhere between 10 to 15 meters, maybe even a little bit taller. And over here we have this huge banner. It must be two, almost three stories high. This is a banner that it was commemorating a Pole that was repatriated. Sorry, not repatriated, rematriated. We use the word rematriation here for this banner because the totem pole that was sent back was on request by Nishka Nation. A Nishka Nation are matrilineal, so their chiefs are women and their lands pass through women. And so rematriation is a way to refer to the fact that women and that kind of traditional structure on women is the important kind of underpinning of that idea. And so this was sent back last month, and we held a ceremony, and the director and the conservators took the pole back up to the valley where the Nishka community live, and they've given it back to the nation. And it's one of those beautiful stories, and we commemorate it here. It's not an absence, it's a presence.
What a beautiful way to give it a presence.
Exactly.
With the banner.
I always think it's funny when museums worry about, oh, if we give all these things back, we're going to have an empty space. I'm like, no, you're going to have a space that's going to be filled with new stories, mm-hmm. new relationships. In Samoa, we have this sense of, we have different philosophical understanding of spaces. We use a term called the va. Mm-hmm. The A, and the A has a long, long emphasis on that va. Mm-hmm. It's a word to refer to space. Space that's not empty, but rather space that connects and is full of ideas and relationships and potential. And I know that, like, Māori have a similar word. I had a group here today, and they were talking about the idea of te po, darkness and emptiness. And like, oh, wait, it's not empty. The darkness is filled with endless potential for something. Mm-hmm. It's just waiting for that. And I see museums, even if they were empty, they're just a space waiting for the potential of a new story. So right now we're heading down, and this actually connects to my time in Bremen. I didn't mention this before. We're heading into this visible storage section that we call the Multiversity Gallery. We use the word multiversity not to kind of emphasize this approach by African scholars to not think about university, a single way of knowing, but rather multiple ways of knowing. When this was built in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 2000s, it was the first time that it was done on such a large scale to have a kind of visible storage area. And in Bremen, they actually copied the Schau magazine there off of what the director at the time saw here. And you see this sort of echoed and repeated as a technique in places like the Musée du Quai Branly, where they have a visible storage area of musical instruments. And even now at the more recent Humboldt Forum, Viola Koenig was based in Bremen, where she copied this idea, and then she went to Berlin, and at the Humboldt Forum they have these mini Schau magazines in certain parts of the gallery. So it's this interesting museological connection between Vancouver and Germany and what I saw there. But the idea of this kind of space was to try to remove the distance between the collection and people. Very often I say that the museum is like an iceberg. You only get to see the tip of the collection. You don't see what's underneath it.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you so much, Nadia.
So.
Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.